Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the General Government of Transportation Committee. It's Thursday, March 29, 2001. At this time, I'm going to open up an informational meeting with a subcommittee, and we're going to be taking a look at an overview of New Zealand transportation program. And we are especially pleased today to have Robin Dunlap, Chief Executive of Transit for New Zealand. And what I'm going to do at this time is open that hearing and ask our good friend to introduce Robin. And so I'll do that at this time. And proceed.
Okay. Senator George and Senator Metzler and Patrick, since you're up there. I'm pleased to introduce Robin Dunlap. Robin and I have been friends for many years, worked on a number of national...
Lloyd, I'm sorry, would you give your name for the record?
Oh, yes, Lloyd Hinion, former ODOT employee and now retired since 1996, but I have my own consulting firm. Robin and I have been friends for many years. I've traveled to New Zealand and seen what he's been doing in New Zealand, and we've served on... national committees together, and over the years I've really become very interested in the way they've changed business operations for highways and roads in New Zealand. And there's lots of different things about New Zealand. One thing is the way they talk, and you'll soon notice that, and they do drive on the wrong side of the road, but other than that. And they also say transit when they really mean highways. But they do get a lot of things right, and that's what I think you're going to hear about today, a good success story. There's a lot of similarities between New Zealand and Oregon. Oregon has about 3 million population. New Zealand has 3.9 million. Both have a large city. Portland's 1.5 million to 2 million. Auckland is about 1.1 million. But there's some differences. Oregon has a major freeway going through it. New Zealand doesn't have that with the islands. They haven't solved that one yet. Getting a channel between the two islands. But anyhow, pleased to have you here, Robin.
Okay, thank you very much. Very happy to be here. I'm sorry I've got my back to everybody, but I presume I have to use this sheet. Is that right?
You do, Robin. Yeah, if you right. could get as close as you could to it.
Okay, right. Well, we'll get right, cut it up to this machine.
Right.
Okay, well, I'm going to quickly flick through this. And we seem to have a bit of a funny system. I don't know why, but it seems to go blank for a minute and then come up again. I don't know why. What the framework of this paper is, I'll just put them all up. All these points. So what I'm going to quickly do is just quick look at road management in New Zealand.
Robin?
Yep.
You take your time. We're fine.
Okay. Weight distance charges, innovative contracting techniques, proposed road reform in New Zealand, issues to, that you might like to consider, just to give you some ideas, a future for direct charging, and then a bit of a conclusion, all right? See if we can get this to move. I don't know why it's doing this, but it's a bit of a quirk, but anyway, it's coming up. We have some nice scenery, and we have the odd nice bridge in New Zealand. We have the state highway network is 10,700 kilometres of road. The other 83,000 kilometres predominantly are run by local government, so that makes up the total network in New Zealand. We do drive on the other side of the road. It's challenging for people coming to New Zealand from America. But we actually now, when some places near where tourists travel, we put arrows on the road showing which side of the road you're supposed to be on, which actually helps. And now, this is in the South Island down near Queenstown. Some of you might have been to Queenstown. And we don't have a lot of traffic down there, so you can get caught if you come out on the wrong side of the road. To talk about the transport reforms, which really started in the late 1980s, this is the government's sort of drivers, where that the transport systems are best carried out by private sector as far as bus services and things like that go, that we should have intermodal neutrality. In other words, we should not have one mode unfairly having an advantage over another because of the cost structures, and we allow a certain amount of competition between the modes. We also had the government interest being confined to strategic policy development, legislation, things like that, and safety regulation was basically the operators and the government working together, so it was a team approach to things. and that cost of safety enforcement would be met by the users. So, for instance, the police enforcement on roads is all paid out of the dedicated road fund. It doesn't come from general government taxation. Now, we had a public works department, and that had about 10,000 employees in 1986, and I was employed as the change manager to assist in pulling to bits the public works department. It did roads, irrigation schemes, a certain amount of dam construction and so on. So it was quite a big organisation. And what we did was we put it into a number of companies. We initially put it into what we call the Works and Development Services Corporation, which had a number of divisions. And we had a consultancy division, a construction division, civil construction division, and then we had a Vogel computer, which was a big mainframe operation. That was the thing of still going in the late 80s, which you wouldn't have that now. And also Works Property Services Division. That was just looking after property. Now, what has happened is these were divisions initially. Then they were either one was a the Vogel Computing was actually staff buyout, and the Works Property Service was actually bought out predominantly by some by staff, but predominantly by Serco in the UK. And then after a few years ago, the consultancy division was actually formed into a company and then bought out by a firm in Malaysia. And the Works Civil Construction was bought out by another big construction company, international company. So all those businesses now are in the private sector, and none of them are owned by the government. So that was what happened there. That's the commercial side of the Works, the original Ministry of Works, the Public Works Department. The regulatory side, which was about 800 people, that went into other organisations, like the road bit initially went into Ministry of Transport, and eventually they formed Transit New Zealand, which I'll talk about later. So what we have now, we can get rid of that lot. We now have the current structure. We have the Minister of Transport, who has a Ministry of Transport, a bit like the ODOT you have here. They look after legislation, strategic policy for the Minister, and also they advise them on how some of our different organisations are going. We have a number of boards, and each organisation that I'm going to show you has a board. We have a Land Transport Safety Authority, which is looking after the rules for vehicle safety, driver behaviour, and also to some extent infrastructure side, particularly speed limits, maximum speed limits and things like that. They have their own board, and they report to the Minister and seek changes that are required to legislation and so on in the area of vehicle driver or infrastructure. We then have a TransFund board, which is a five-member board, and that looks after the dedicated road fund, and it funds the local roads, the local authorities, our state highways, and Transit New Zealand, and passenger transport, or transit you call it. Then we have Transit New Zealand, which is the one I'm chief executive of, and our control is state highways. And then we have, in the next box, there's actually two bodies. I only show one box there for brevity. We have a civil aviation authority and also a maritime safety authority. They're both separate bodies with their own boards, and they do, like the land transport on the left-hand side, look after the rules in those sectors and recommend to the government any changes. So that gives you an idea of the structure. Now, the dedicated fund, basically, the government sets the income as far as how many cents a litre goes into the fund from light vehicle, that's petrol tax. We have a weight distance tax, and the government would set that if they needed to change it, and also vehicle licensing and registration. I'll talk about that later. Now, the trans fund is the body that determines what expenditure goes to local roads, state highways, or passenger transport from the dedicated fund. The caveats they have is the government could issue a directive if they wanted to say that they say wanted something done differently with passenger transport. And if they did, they would have to be gazetted and actually tabled in the House. So it was a very transparent process. Also, we have with the Minister, all the bodies have a performance agreement which lays out things that the government want to see achieved and how we should operate and work with the government. And the other thing about the dedicated fund is it's not to go into deficit. It has to have a certain amount of surplus in the fund at all times. Now, I don't want to go through this in great detail. It's a quite complicated process, but I can't really get up either because I need the microphone. But on the right-hand side, there's a general tax for petrol, 18.7 cents actually does go into the general consolidated fund of government. That's just an all taxation measure, and the rest all goes into the dedicated fund, which is just slightly in the blue box on the right. That's the fuel tax revenue to charge motor vehicle licensing and registration. And from that, the money goes to the police for enforcement on the roads, Land Transport Safety Authority for carrying out the safety measures, safety advertising, all that sort of measures. And then it goes, the balance goes to the trans fund in the middle there, that blue box in the middle, which then is distributed to ourselves, transit, to councils, and to the regional council for looking after passenger transport. They look after passenger transport or transit, and they also have a planning, regional planning role. So that gives you some idea of what happens in that area. Now, the trans fund board, they allocate the funds, as I said, to the different areas. They also have a role of auditing to make sure the funds are spent properly. They also approve competitive pricing procedures for bidding work. We generally develop them, and then they tick them off and make sure that they're fair and reasonable. Allocation of funds to outputs. In excess of 70% of our national state highway program is subject to some form of benefit cost analysis. So it's quite a rigorous process of looking at the efficiency of the expenditure. We have two main systems for looking at maintenance money. We have asset management systems, which across all the state highways and most of all local roads. And also we have formal project evaluation procedures, which I'll talk about in a minute. This is the benefit cost process. You're pretty familiar with that. The benefits comprise vehicle operating costs, time savings, accident savings, increased comfort and less dust. In other words, we have a measure on unsealed roads. We have a measure for dust, so many cents per vehicle kilometre, and also reduce noise if you have to reduce noise. On the cost side, of course, you've got the capital, and then, of course, you can have a positive or negative depending on whether maintenance is going to go up or down. Usually it goes down. So that's how they're analysed. Just a bit about New Zealand. Transit New Zealand itself, we have our own act. We can be sued by any individual or company. We're a road controlling authority. We prepare our program, submit it to Transfund for approval, and the level of funding that we get, of course, depends on how much is in the dedicated fund. Our roles are managing the highways, developing standards and guidelines. We provide a bit of assistance to local government, and we're ensuring activities, programs in the National Roading Program for state highways are achieved. We represent New Zealand internationally in a number of forums, and also we have a role in our National Road Safety Committee. I personally am a member of that National Road Safety Committee, along with police and Land Transport Safety Authority, Ministry of Transport, and so on. This is how we're structured at the present time. We have it's called an authority. It really is a board, but six-member board. That board is appointed jointly by the Minister of Transport and the Minister of Finance. The Chief Executive is myself. I have compliance and assurance manager, which is like an internal audit function, just one person. And I have a human resource section. We then have on the left-hand side a salary policy division. They look after standards, specifications, and help with government policy input into it if it's needed. We have a property division managing the property that we're holding for ready for road building. We have corporate services and financial services that actually has been combined and just recently. And then we have an operational division in the state highway management division. And we have seven regional officers. The role of the regional officers is just basically to look after the program, look after the consultants, make sure the contractors are doing their job, and monitor the program. We have what we call a government statement of intent. This is like a contract with the government, or actually with our minister, and we have to actually say what we're going to achieve each year, and then we report on those achievements in our annual report every year, which of course is tabled in the House. And we have performance measures. We're very much focused on performance measures, so you can actually measure what we're doing. We value our roading network every year. We carry out measure the roughness of our roads. We measure the skid resistance or the ability to hold cars on the road. We measure that, and we report these so that we know how our network is going each year. The minister, of course, is very much has an ownership interest in the roads. All the roads, the state highways, are actually on the Crown balance sheet. The government in New Zealand actually has a balance sheet for the whole government, and those assets are on the balance sheet at about $10 billion. That's based on a depreciated replacement basis. And also, the performance agreement does deal with any procedures that the minister wants us to follow and so on. Wage distance charge, you're well aware of that. I'm not going to talk much about that here, but we have a weight distance charge on all heavy vehicles, and any diesel vehicle has to pay a distance charge, that is, and any vehicle under 3.5 tonnes, they get a distance charge because we don't have any fuel tax on diesel. It's only on petrol. The weight distance tax was introduced in 1978, and the weight distance and petrol tax are determined using a cost allocation model. The cost, you're very familiar with this, I'm sure. We still use the old fourth power law. We're doing a lot of research. We've got a little test track in New Zealand. We're looking at that. The fourth power law, I think, is, doesn't always apply to some of our pipes of pavements, and we might have to change that. You know all about the argument of fixed costs, variable costs, and all that. Don't need to go about through all that. And heavy vehicles, of course, pay a higher share of the road costs because we're using a weight distance tax like you do. Allocate the current cost each year, so expenditure is equivalent to cost is correct for a mature network. In other words, of course, we're not spreading the cost of capital per se, but then if you're doing a reasonably even amount of work, it generally works out reasonably well. So once all expenditure has been apportioned, charges can be calculated. I don't think there's a lot there we need to talk about. You're all familiar with all this stuff, so. One thing we do find with the road user charge, you do because they're having to pay for trailers, the configuration that they use on the road is perhaps different than other countries where they're using a fuel tax. That's one thing we have noticed, and we have had it reviewed by a peer reviewed, and they found our system was quite advanced compared to most countries because there's not many doing, as you know, the weight distance tax. Right, now let's get into probably the more interesting area that you're really interested in. It's really contracting out. I described it earlier on in the paper in this presentation about how we took the whole Public Works Department and got it originally into companies, and then eventually it was sold. So they are now, of course, out in the private sector competing with any other private sector company. So we have developed some innovative contracting techniques. We've contracted out all our maintenance construction. We did that right at the beginning. We developed originally the competitive pricing procedures, and we are also being very instrumental in looking at packaging the work. We've tried all different combinations of whether you should put a whole lot of work of a similar type together in a large area versus a small area. The things we've learned is that in certain parts of the country, rural areas particularly, you've got to be careful that you don't eliminate the small contractors, otherwise you won't have them for the future. Whereas in the bigger centres where there's a lot of work going on, it doesn't matter so much, you can do it differently. We've moved into introduction of partnering and value management, and what that means is that we actually get everybody around the table and we start a project. We get the community on board, we get the truckers, we get the contractors, the consultants, the environmental groups, the local government, we bring them all together and we actually discuss the project, how we're going to approach it, and what we can do, and then we get them to put in new ideas. And then the value management is that anybody at any time can suggest changes which might make savings. So we had a recent case where we had two contractors working on a large project, one at one end, one at the other, and one contractor was having trouble with a piece of road because it was very poor material, and we found that the other contractor actually had their depot sitting on a little knob. And this little knob had very good aggregate, and that other contractor suggested that perhaps they could move their depot and they could take away that knob and use that fill material. So that shows you what you can do with this type of concept of partnering and value management. And in the old days, we'd never think of that. We'd have a really opposing approach to it. So it's a very powerful technique and certainly can bring about some major savings. We've also gone to long-term performance specified maintenance contracts. These are basically 10 years. We've tried to look at the optimum time for these contracts. We've done a lot of 3-year and up to 5-year contracts, but we felt that so ideally, if we could go to 10-year contracts, we can actually get the contractor to take ownership of the road for a long period and think about the road in a sort of a own the actual road itself and try and develop it in a proper way. Now, these long-term performance contracts, we do not tell them when they should do maintenance. Fill potholes, that we have a specification that says you're not allowed to have potholes more than 48 hours long and on the road, and so on. So we actually look at our results we want. We say we mustn't have a skid resistance lower than a certain value at all over the network. We actually have different grades for intersections and linear parts of the network and curved parts of the network, but they're not allowed to go below that. So we will do random checks on them. We'll run a machine over to check them. We also say they mustn't go below certain roughnesses on the network. So it's a very much an output-based approach to things. Now, just looking at the general maintenance, we have developed these long-term procurement strategies, and we have what we call the conventional three-year contracts. That was sort of where we started when we started contracting out, setting up three-year contracts where we had a traditional consultant who worked as our client, as our agent, and they managed the contractor. And we've still got a lot of those, and they work pretty well. Then we've moved to what we call a hybrid, where we've tried to introduce some parts of performance specified maintenance contracts, but not gone totally down that track. And we've introduced them on the basis of they've got a contract for 3 years. If they're performing well, they get another year, and they're really still performing well, they get another year. So it actually can be a five-year contract. So we've got a bit of incentive in there. And then the last one is the one I just described, which is the 10-year contracts. In construction, we have the conventional approach, which is you design it and then you put it out to bid and construct it. We're doing some design and build, and we've got a number of variations on the design and build. And then we're moving now to full delivery, where we actually engage a consultant separately from a contractor without using any price. We just use what you call the Brooks Law, which is basically a thing that's developed in America, where you actually do it on the quality of the proposals put forward. And then you get the two together, and they develop a design, and you negotiate on price. It's a very new concept we're just working on at the moment. The beauty of that concept is that you can get some quickly designed and then start building some, and not having to wait to do the whole process, which takes a lot of time.
Senator Carter, I'd like to welcome Robin. We have with us now State Senator Margaret Carter, part of our committee, and also Representative Zahner, and who is very interested in this subject. So I'm glad to have the two of them here. And Senator Carter, you had a question.
Yeah, would you go back to the design, please? Go back to your former.
Design bill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, under design build, did I understand you just say that you get the design and that you don't quiver or equivocate over the design piece of it, but just the cost of the project itself?
Yeah, what we do is, that's actually under the full delivery approach. That's the last one, where we actually appoint a consultant and then a contractor, where we appoint them on the basis of their ability to do the job and not on price. So then they start and design a project, and then we negotiate on the price of that project. Okay, so it's quite a different concept. Now, it has some risks. This is a risky game because if you have enough knowledge, and of course, if you're building enough projects, you've got a fair idea what it costs per kilometre to build projects. So you should be able to keep pretty well, pretty close eye on it. Up till now, we have not done this. We have very much gone, not always on price. We've done a lot on what we call quality price trade-off, which sounds complicated, but basically, we have a weighting system where price would be perhaps say 70%, and the rest would be on the quality of the bid performer, the consultant or the contractor. For consultants, quite often we have done it without doing it on price, because that's quite different. And especially if you're doing investigation work, you're bidding there. You can't really bid on price, so you do it on quality. But in the consulting area, a lot of it has been done on say 30% price. And 70% on the quality of their bid. In other words, what's their track record, what's their methodology about going about this project, and so on. So we've got it's actually these procurement strategies, which are available to you if you want them, and we're very happy to make them available. They are quite comprehensive. It's not something I can talk about quickly, but this is sort of just the general concepts we've developed. It's taken us over 10 years to develop these concepts. So far, we've only been challenged once in court, and we're still in the court process on that. We're still pretty confident we'll get out there, but one never knows. You know? But so far, we've managed to withstand a number of audits and all the rest, and not been not found wanting. So it is very important, though, in any bidding process, that you have a very good process and you stay with it, and you don't deviate from it, don't try and change your mind halfway through and all that sort of thing. You've got to be very careful, because a bidding process is just like a legal process. Once you start the process, you really can't start changing the rules, unless everybody agrees, all the bidders all agree. So it's really, quality process is very, very important. And you've got to have good evaluators of evaluating the bids as well. Okay?
That would be an interesting concept here, Mr. Chairman.
And Robin, we have someone out at Redmond Airport. The manager a few years ago was describing a process very similar to what you do. That's what she did. And the quality of the work was just outstanding. It was amazing when you ask for quality and are willing to pay a little bit to get quality, you can actually achieve what you guys are achieving.
Yeah, we have an interesting intention with our TransFund funding body, where, of course, they are looking, obviously, for the best value for dollars, so they're looking at the dollars. And trying to trade off those two is challenging. You can't always just trade for the lowest price. And you've got to be very careful about low price bids. I mean, a lot of contractors quite like them. It's great for us as far as legally we know. If we get the lowest price, we take it. We're not going to get it up in court. We just, you know, it's virtually impossible. But it doesn't necessarily achieve the right result. So it's challenging. We have one court case, a district court actually adjudicated that when we were evaluating, that we were actually making judgment calls on this contractor, and they were a little offended by that. But unfortunately, of course, that's the way of the world. If you're actually going to have that sort of process that doesn't use just bottom line, you have to make some judgments on it. As long as it's fair and seen to be fair, I think you that's the best you can do. I mean, occasionally you're probably going to get it wrong. In any system you have, you might just make a slight slip when you're doing the evaluation. Can't get it wrong. So far, touch wood, we've done very, very well. But you really, you know, you've got to have a good. I just can't overemphasize. If you have a good process, you will be well rewarded. And I think the real thing is the figures I've been quoting today is, in the 11 years that we've been in operation, we're now in the same real dollars. We're spending the same. Virtually exactly the same real dollars on our network in maintaining it. It is in better quality as far as our measures go, as far as skid resistance and things like that is. But what's more interesting, for the same dollars that we're spending, we're now carrying 52% more traffic. So in effect, we're getting those 52% basically they're traveling for free, in effect. So what we can do is we can use the money that we're still getting that is increasing as the weight distance tax goes up with the extra money, we can use that for capital projects. So when we started, we were doing 86% on maintenance. We're now down to about 46% on maintenance on the same network.
Robin, my understanding from the conversation we had earlier that the savings then go roll up into construction.
No, they can roll into construction. Yeah. We actually have to declare any savings. It goes back to TransFund. They reallocate it, but, of course, they naturally have covered the maintenance, so they can allocate it to construction. Yeah. Or passenger transport, of course, or whatever. Okay, so just some thoughts here. I just sort of project a bit forward here. I thought, you know, we haven't talked about this today, but you might be interested in this. I think what you've got to think about is in any structure should be designed to meet the key outputs that road users consider essential. Now, we have tried to move away from thinking of roads as bitumen or asphalt, or you call it asphalt over here, stones, concrete and stuff like that. We're looking at what is it? It is really a utility service. We're providing a service to the community. They want to get from A to B, and they want to get there on time and so on, and they want to get there safely. So what we're trying to do is we go out and talk to, we actually do surveys of the users. We ask them about our road network, and they're not always perfectly pleasant about our network, as you can imagine. We get a bit of flack, especially in the urban areas, we get congestion. But we also say to them, well, that's all right, but what about, you know, we've only got so much money. What about if we want to change that and do what you want? They, for instance, always wanting more passing lanes on the two-lane roads. They want more passing lanes. We said, well, were you prepared to pay an extra 10 cents a litre or whatever, or 2 cents a litre? And we actually surveyed that as well, which is good. Now, what we found was we did a survey with the trucking organisations, and we found that the trucking organisations said that our roads were rough in some cases. Now, we couldn't believe that because we measure the roughness. We are as good as any state in Australia. We benchmark well with internationally, and yet they say some of our roads are rough. What we found, though, was the trucks, because of their different axle spacings, they actually were going in and out of the sort of the longitudinal waves in some of the roads, and also the lateral roads sometimes are a bit lower on one side than the other, and they were getting this rocking motion, and they were feeling quite bad about that. So what we did was we just developed a sort of, we worked out with the data we had on the roughness we had at each wheel path, we worked out what we call a truck indicator. And we established that some areas we actually could actually correct them by not too much money. We've actually put $3 million in this current year into actually correcting some of the worst areas. And we've had very positive feedback from the truckies because we listened to what they said and we fed it back into the system. So we're really in that sort of trying to provide service to the users and give them. We can't always give them what they want. They want passing lanes area. We haven't got that money. We put a lot less money per capita than you do in the United States into roads. But what we're trying to do is do our very best with the money we've got. All right. So that's so what I'm really saying there is you've got to look at outputs and not worry about inputs. In other words, don't worry about putting bitumen on the road. It's actually what you're trying to achieve. You want a road which is sort of as safe as you can get it, with a good skid resistance, so that people don't slide off the road when it rains. Good delineation. One thing we have done in New Zealand is put a lot of marker posts on the side of the road with very good reflectors on, cat's eyes. We've used some rumble strips on the Volvo roads. We've really looked at delineation. And we have a lot of very torturous country. We've put speedways on the curves and so on. So we put a lot of emphasis into that. We have a sort of philosophy in transit that our road should be what we call a no surprises environment. In other words, when you drive the road at the correct speed, you will get out the other end safe and not run off the road. Of course, if you don't obey the rules, you'll go off the road. But we don't want roads which are actually dangerous, and you can't tell as a driver by visibly looking at them or reading the sign. You can't tell that. We don't want that. That's not acceptable in our place. In fact, I have my regional managers each year look at the roads, actually survey their roads, and they actually have to sign a certification to say that they are safe as far as they can be, and if they aren't, what are they doing about it? They've got to tell me, they've got to say they're trying to get funds to fix them, or they're actually signposts for dangers. All right, so it's a very much a more accountability. Remember, of course, we can be sued, and all our skid resistance results are actually available to the police, which of course means they are available to the public, and we're getting people now trying to sue us. But as long as we've done our best to fix the problem and haven't sat on it behind, and if we know about a problem and haven't fixed it, we deserve to be told, got to be taken to court. And that's really what it's all about, is transparency. And I know a lot of countries won't actually do the skid resistance testing and expose it to the public because they're scared of getting caught in litigation. Well, somewhere someone has to be accountable. That's my view.
Robin, one thing, and you said the word right there, and that's where I was headed with my question. That was accountable. You take the surveys, you find out what the truckers want, you find out what the car drivers want. If you go out and ask for an increase of so many cents per liter, do you then deliver those projects? Because that's a complaint we get constantly. You know, you guys come all the time asking for more gas tax increases. We've given them to you. We went from 8 cents to 24 cents. What did we get? That's the question we hear all the time. When you guys go out and make a pitch that you're going to actually deliver something, what is your attitude towards actually getting that done? Are you very sensitive to making sure that you deliver on promises?
I think it's a very good point. We fortunately haven't had to do too much of that because we keep on making these efficiency gains and we can use that money instead. So, and of course, that's a lot of our people, when you do those user surveys, many of them say, look, we would like you to reprioritize money. They don't like increasing charges, as you know. I think it's a key, though, in where you go around the world, that in any survey you do, the users always say, provided you put it into the road, doing the jobs we want, we're happy about it. I think that's it. You'll find most surveys show that. But we've actually done virtually all of ours out of savings.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, I'll just push on. I mean, there's a big debate of whether you should privatise the roads. We've done a lot of work on that, and I think it's a very dangerous game to get into privatising roads. I know there's some people have privatised them in terms of concessions, 30-year concessions and that. And it's interesting to watch in the UK what's happening there now. They've actually done that for some of their roads. They've actually got some good prices because they've gone for whole life cost of the roads. But what they've now found is they built a lot of concrete roads and they found they're very noisy And they're getting a lot of complaints, and the government's now having to step in and say, we'll better overlay them with asphalt. And, of course, it's costing millions of dollars because you've now got a captive contractor. So you've got to be very careful about that. So I think you've really got to keep roads in the public ownership. I just don't think you can get into doing anything else. We've worked for sort of a smart buyer organisation. We're buying the services from the outside sector. One thing I didn't mention, actually, another advantage in getting into contracting out is that it forces the road owner or client, you might call it, to really think, what do they want? Because you can't just roll up to a construction gang and say, let's build something. You actually have to sit down and specify it. You have to think about what you're doing. And in the early days, we found that was invaluable because we didn't really know what we really wanted. And we found that a very sobering exercise. And I think you can get a lot of the savings that we're getting are actually coming in that area as well, not just from direct the contractor down. So I just forgot to mention that. Sorry about that. Concentrate on road users' willingness to pay. I think this is something important. We've done a number of willingness to pay surveys. We all know there's weaknesses in those surveys. People are naturally always happy to say, oh, I'm willing to pay an extra 10 cents. But when it comes to putting their hand in their pocket, it's more like 5 cents that they'll pay. But it does give you some idea, and it's a good technique as far as we're concerned. New technology, we're looking at, of course, and like you are in the States, we think technology is going to be a great help to us in the future. We can't fix all the safety problems on our roads. We've got roads, we've got very large drops, 2,000 or 3,000 metres in some cases off our roads. We can't put guardrail over all the roads. You just couldn't afford to. There are a lot of safety techniques which can guide people on their roads, and we think that this is probably the way of the future. Road system reliability, just measuring the reliability of a system using technology, we think is also great. And these are the sort of things that we're finding that the users want. They want safety, they want road system reliability, they want the roads open, as you know, they never want them closed. They want a good low-stress road and not bumpy comfort. They obviously want efficiency, and they want, obviously, for a good price. So these are the sort of five parameters we find that always comes up in any discussion with user groups. They're sort of the drivers. Now, in the technology, we see that technology will certainly help. I mean, obviously, as vehicles become more fuel efficient, you get less emissions, and that the emission issue may not be as great as it is a worry at the moment. We've got to bear that in mind. And obviously, technology can help provide free-flowing traffic, as you know, with traffic management systems and so on. So technology clearly is a major focus for the future. And intelligent roads, well, you understand all about this. I'd like to see it go a lot further, that we can actually remotely monitor the roads. I'd like to see us being able to remotely monitor signs that get damaged. We have a chip in the sign or something like that, and actually know when it gets knocked over, that we can actually tell it straight away that these damages are occurring, and that we can help with assisting more accurate estimation of road user costs, and we can obviously do pavement monitoring too remotely, so you can actually know a lot more about your pavements, so you don't have to physically be all the time measuring things. Right, that's it.
Okay. Thank you, Robin. Robin, I have a couple questions first, if I may. What in your petrol tax, what is the, for passenger vehicles, what is the current gasoline tax there in New Zealand?
Yeah, I should have actually checked it out before it is. It's very complicated because there's the 18.7 cents goes to the condensate fund, and then there's some, I think it's 26 cents goes into the dedicated fund. There's a little bit going into petroleum monitoring and a few other things, but then there's also a GST on the total lot as well, which is.
But in terms of how much?
It's about 40 something cents, I think, something like that.
40 some cents.
It's 40 cents
per
liter.
Per liter.
Yeah.
So on a gallon basis, that would be.
A lot of tax.
About $1.80 or something.
Yeah,
gallon.
But a lot of that, is general tax.
Uh-huh.
Not going to the dedicated fund. Okay.
Well. In terms of your automobile licensing fees, what does it cost to license a car? And
it's just about $200 to license a car, $190.
Okay.
But that's New Zealand dollars, by the way, too. These are all New Zealand dollars.
Right, I understand. Yeah. Okay.
You've got less than half of them. It's about 41 cents at the moment, so our dollar's not worth much.
Okay. I was also interested in your point when you said about your experience, especially looking at the UK, is that in terms of private roads, you recommended a lot of caution going in that direction, that keeping the roads in the public sector was an important concept to look at and to because of the experience with the quality of some of those roads. Would you just kind of elaborate on that a bit for me?
Yeah, well, I think you got to think when you move basically a road offline, if it's a brand new road and it's to a tourist resort or something separate, there's no problem with that. But if it's a part of your main network and you actually take it offline and you in effect privatize it for 30 years, you're really limited to what you can actually do with that network. If you want to change the way you want to manage that network in terms of what you push down the network and so on, you're very limited to what you can do. You're also, if you want to do what they're doing in the UK now and to relay asphalt over a lot of the concrete roads with noise, you're going to have to work with that contractor and pay the price that he wants to charge, because you can't really do anything else. You can't go in and start bringing another contractor because you're going to get into warranty problems and all those sort of things. So think, you've got to really think through that. I don't say this is necessarily a bad or a good thing. What I say is one needs to think it through. Mm-hmm. Because roads are networks. They're not individual little bits. Mm-hmm. And it does need a lot of thinking.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask one more. I'm curious about your freight movement in New Zealand. Now, we, in Oregon, move a great deal of our freight by truck, 40,000, 80,000 pound, 100,000 truck. I know you have pretty good rail system there also in New Zealand, freight moves there. How much would you say of your freight movement in New Zealand is on the highway or the road as opposed to freight? I mean, how large of a trucking business do you have in New Zealand for movement of freight?
Well, it's still quite big, but because it isn't as big as yours, because we haven't got the interstate traffic that you have. Now, you've got more trucks. There's no doubt about it. You see your roads, you can see more trucks. It's still, though, over 80% on the roads. And you've got the thing is, though, you see, the trouble with rail is it isn't doing the distributional trucking in the urban areas. And that's where, of course, they just don't even compete there. So that's what makes it hard. They are basically competing on the longer haul, and we haven't got such long hauls that you have because it's just a small country. So therefore it is hard. But they're into basically logs and coal. They're actually cutting quite a lot of milk now on the rail. You're right about the rail. Rail is actually privatized in New Zealand. But they're finding it pretty tough at the moment. They're doing a lot of rethinking about their rail operation. They've been in the passenger transport business, the long haul, some long haul passenger, and also freight. They're now actually looking at actually selling off the passenger freight business and the long haul passenger business and actually just concentrating on freight only. They also operate a lot of boats across ships between the islands, so they actually run their rail right through because that carts trucks too. It's interesting though, the rail operation in New Zealand operates, and they don't own them, but they actually operate for owner operators, the largest trucking fleet in New Zealand. So that probably indicates that, again, we're not into roads and rail, we're into logistics. What is the business? Mm-hmm. It's nothing to do with road rail, it's logistics.
Mm-hmm. So what I heard you say, you really don't have any interstate, so to speak. Got a few wide roads going into Auckland, a few things, but pretty
that's
well.
Cool. And that's the difference. Exactly. You'll notice the roads generally in New Zealand are reasonably good standard of the highways. But we just about sealed the whole side. We've got a few little remote bits. We're just about finished. But you won't find a very large percentage of four-lane roads.
Right.
We need more. There's no doubt about we need more, and that's where the money is going right now. But we haven't been putting a lot of capital into roads over the years. So what we've done is, if you can't get the cow, you drive the efficiencies, and that's one way to get it.
Robin, could you describe for us, too, the total number of employees that were in that original department, how you brought that population now working with employees, and what kind of savings that produced for the country?
Yeah, okay. Well, you've got to be very careful when you talk about the number of employees. I mean, you can concentrate very easily on we had a 10,000 public works department, but that was doing everything. I mean, you've got to remember that. It was managing army bases and so on. Probably only about half that would be operating in the roading sector. It was obviously the big sector. But again, what we did was, we put them into companies, the commercial part into companies, or into divisions, divisions first, then companies, and we gave them a chance to become commercial and operate like private companies. So we didn't just put a whole lot of people down the road. Some people did get down the road, because what we found is when you start looking at a big bureaucracy, is that some will clearly have a role in the regulatory arms of the business, and they go there. Others go in the commercial, and then some fall down the crack. The people that count the pencils and that don't actually have a role in the new modes, you know. So that bureaucracy stuff disappears, so you do lose a small percentage. But what we did was we actually, when we started this whole process, we sat down with, we had a working group working on it, and we had the union members involved. We had a couple of reps, and they were part of the exercise. We've got to have staff involvement right through the process. You've got to ask for confidentiality in that process, but you've got to have involvement of the staff. Otherwise, you're going to blow it.
Okay. Oh, certainly. Yeah.
Just follow up. Just so I understand, as we talk about maybe comparing to what we do in Oregon, because we have an inclusive transportation department or Department of Transportation, what you've done is that you just have different divisions. I mean, you have Transit New Zealand, you have the Land Transportation Authority, the Ministry of Transport, the Accident Compensation Corporation, local authorities, and all those.
Correct.
I noticed in reading up on the Land Transport Authority, they say at any one day, because they do contract out a lot of their services, said that some material I had from them said that on any one day they have as many as 11,000 people that may be working for the Land Transport Authority, but most of which are doing contracted services.
And so that's correct. They contract out all the photo, the driver licensing and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
Absolutely. And they actually, at the moment, collect the road user charges, so they have a team. They do actually have quite a reasonable size team working on that, but most of it is contracted out.
Yeah. Right. Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Robin, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
I don't know if you're going to be able to stay here, but I just realized how parallel this was, New Zealand being a place that has a weight mile tax, and we're about to get receive a report on our weight mile tax work group, and what we're trying to do is do a little streamlining here, and work group is about to present their findings, and if you'd like, we'd love to have you stay, and if you think you have some great ideas, we'd be willing to hear those too.
All right. Thank you.
All right, thanks very much. We'll kind of stand at ease for a little bit and wait till we clear the technologies here, and then we'll ask Anthony Ruffalo to come on up. Okay. You can just shut it down, Richard, if you want, and I'll pick it up later. How much tape do you have left? Can you tell? Okay, normally we'll indicate, you know, what percentage of tape. Oh, okay. I know.
So if you want to head on back,
we have this tape going on this now.
Oh, okay.
Just shut it down, and I'll pick it up later. Okay. Oh, okay. All right. Maybe we'll see you in the background. Well, we're going to get some still pictures of you being here. Maybe we could run down so we can get some batteries before they leave.
Works well.
You get help. Thanks again.
Yes, sir.
One of the representatives from outside.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thank you. Yeah,
you really
have something to pass. Yeah, that's
we're back in action here. Dr. Ruffalo, I want to thank you and half of your work group for being here today. I think that's pretty amazing to have you guys here. Shows the real interest that you put into this piece of research for us. And we're anxious to hear your report. So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourselves and then however you've decided to present this. We're ready to hear you.
Thank you, Senator George, Senator Carter. I'm Tony Ruffalo. I was chair of the Weight Mile Streamlining Work Group, which this committee created. And surrounding me are some of the other members, Greg Del Ponte, John Maris, and Lloyd Henyon. Their full affiliations are in Appendix A and a listing of the rest of the committee members. As you're aware, the work group was requested to find methods to reduce state administrative costs, as well as compliance costs to the motor carrier industry, and to the extent feasible, look at issues that might generate revenue for the state. We were ably assisted by Patrick Balducci. We also benefited, ODOT has a work group with similar name, weight mile tax, I think was simplification work group between ODOT and the trucking industry, and we benefited by having the minutes of their meetings available to us. One caveat I want to mention, there are a number of estimates in here of revenue generation or administrative cost savings, and while we thank Mr. Del Ponte and his staff for generating those savings, we do want to emphasize, and these are very rough estimates, that there was very little time for actual extensive analysis in generating any of these numbers. With that said, I'd like to just briefly go through the recommendations that came out of the work group and briefly explain them, and then if anybody, any of the other work group members have any comments, please feel free to jump in. The first recommendation is to eliminate the requirement for heavy vehicles to have an Oregon tax plate. Oregon now requires out-of-state trucks to have an Oregon tax plate. Most states do not have this requirement. They rely on the interstate registration plan, and the industry basically finds then that not only do they have to get these plates and put them on, we heard some evidence that tracking down the trucks and getting the plates to the trucks when they're involved in interstate commerce might also create difficulties. So generally, the recommendation was that it would be a substantial simplification to the industry to eliminate the requirement for an Oregon tax plate. Now, the impact on the industry is estimated to save $1.2 million annually for the industry in the specific fee that they pay for the tax plate. Now, that would also then necessarily involve a reduction of a similar amount in the revenue which the state receives for the tax plate. On the other hand, the state must administer the tax plate program, and the estimate is that it would save an estimated $305,000 per year for the administration of the tax plate program. This primarily is associated with actually purchasing the plates, warehousing them, distributing them to the motor carriers when they make their application. Other major revenue or cost issue associated with this is that the department estimates that there would be a one-time computer conversion cost of $325,000 to make the transition to using the interstate registration plan as opposed to using the individual Oregon tax plate. But basically, there was a substantial amount of discussion about the issues of tax compliance and other issues. And the general feeling seemed to be that there really wasn't much of an impact on the state's ability to enforce tax compliance, and yet that there would be a savings to the industry. And so this was recommended as a change in the procedure. Anybody have any further comments? Or
just on that, Tony, we all agreed that if it really isn't going to make any difference in terms of the administration, even though the state might lose some money on it, we still wanted to recommend it because we think it's a unnecessary cost to the industry.
Okay.
Our second recommendation is to restructure the existing weight mile bonding program. As indicated, ODOT has the ability to require bonds to collect taxes and other fees owed to the state. The information that we received indicate that currently the bond inventory exceeds $60 million. Based upon evidence presented, the cost to a motor carrier of posting a bond is approximately 10% if they post the bond through a private bonding agency, or alternatively they can put up a cash bond. So the estimate is that of that $60 million, the cost to the industry is about 10% of that, or about $6 million per year, to simply post the bonds that are required by the state. On the other hand, the evidence provided by ODOT is that the state redeemed less than $500,000 per year over the last three fiscal years. This did not seem to justify the impact that the bonding requirement has on the industry. There were a number of issues that were raised, however. The most important one is that while the state may only be collecting $500,000, the existence of the bond may ensure more compliance than we would get if the bonding requirement were reduced. And so while we're recommending that the bonding requirement be reduced, we are also recommending that it be carefully monitored to see if the rate of default increases, and that there might be some potential for ODOT to want to go back and reinstate some of the bonding requirements. The general feeling, however, was that ODOT could reasonably restructure its requirements for bonding, that, for example, for carriers with strong credit ratings and a good record of payment of taxes, that the bonding requirements might be eliminated, and for carriers that do not necessarily meet the credit ratings but do show consistent payment of taxes and good safety records and so on, that they would also have some discretion to eliminate the bonding requirements there. We do recommend, however, that they retain the authority to require bonds for carriers that do not meet the credit ratings, that do not consistently make their tax payments on time, or that have other problems, particularly problems associated with safety. Basically, this does not require a statutory change. It's basically a recommendation for ODOT to restructure its rulemaking authority. Further comments or? Okay, thank you. Our third recommendation is to give carriers the option to report quarterly rather than monthly, but allow carriers who wish to continue to report monthly to do so. This was probably the most controversial recommendation. As you will know, we currently have an exemption. Carriers that are expected to have annual tax burdens of less than $3,600 may file quarterly. All other carriers are currently required to file monthly. One of the reasons for the monthly requirement is, in a sense, to even out the flow of revenue to the state. And the motor carrier industry, however, argues that, for example, for filing fuel taxes, that they're allowed to report those quarterly, and that most of the other taxes allow for a quarterly reporting. However, Oregon does require them to make their reporting and payments on a monthly basis. Now, the quarterly reporting would be expected to reduce the compliance cost to the industry. It would presumably be four payments rather than 12. On the other hand, there is a substantial issue here in terms of the interest cost to the state and the interest savings to the industry. Basically, by going to quarterly reporting, since the weight mile tax is paid after the tax liability is generated, the industry would be able to defer 1 or 2 months' worth of payments each quarter and make those payments at the end of the quarter rather than during the quarter. This would generate either reduced interest cost or interest savings to the trucking industry. On the other hand, it also creates either a loss in interest income or an interest cost to the state to even out the cash flow that would be associated with that. The estimates that we saw, again, very rough, were approximately $1.1 million per year in higher interest costs to the state if this were to be adopted by a large percentage of the trucking industry. The change also has the potential to increase the losses to the state due to default, since the average balance owed would be greater for motor carriers. Basically, then, the final result of this was that there was a 5-3 favorable vote, with the three persons in the minority feeling that the interest cost to the state and the increased risk of default outweighed the savings and convenience for the industry, the 5-member majority feeling that the savings to the industry and convenience outweighed the interest loss to the state. This was the only recommendation in which there was not a consensus, and so I did want to point that out. Is there any other discussion?
Let me frame it. Very fair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, our fourth recommendation, continue ODOT's e-government initiative. Now, basically what we found out was that the e-government initiative is that there are a number of things that ODOT has been doing. We received a substantial amount of information on their offering motor carriers internet access to customer-initiated transactions and a variety of other things. We did have some discussion of the Greenlight Way Station preclearance program, which uses transponders to and allows for electronic screening of trucks at the busiest way stations. Basically, trucks can be weighed in motion, and if the information is all correct and everything is appropriate, then they don't have to actually stop and go through a lot of the record checks that were historically required. Basically, the group simply encourages continued development of the e-government initiatives. It looks like there will be substantial opportunities for administrative cost savings. I think the substantive recommendation that came out of this is that where there are savings in the administrative cost to the state by motor carriers taking advantage of the electronic reporting options, that some of those savings be passed back to the industry to encourage them to engage in these options. The final recommendation was that the motor carrier division look at the potential for private sector involvement in the electronic reporting of taxes. There are a number of potential systems out there, one that we heard extensive discussion on, known as CWARM, where basically the state would set requirements to allow for a concessionaire to be certified, and that if the concessionaire becomes certified, the motor carrier industry then has the option of making an arrangement with the certified concessionaire to both report their miles and collect taxes. And we think that there is substantial potential there for integrating a variety of services and for allowing for private sector participation in the provision of these services. Are there other comments? Okay. Moving on to recommendation number 5, eliminate or restrict exemptions to the weight mile tax. Right now, there are a variety of exemptions to the weight mile tax, including farm trucks, vehicles operated by charitable organizations, public transit buses, school buses, and other vehicles owned by counties and cities. We heard some discussion from industry representatives that they perceived some of the use of trucks, particularly by local governments, as being in direct competition with services that they could provide to the local governments, and that the local government vehicles were, in effect, because they were tax exempt, receiving an advantage relative to the private sector operators in terms of their ability to compete in offering services to these local governments. There were also some questions as to the cost that this generates for the state and the public policy purpose that is generated by these exemptions. The estimate is that there would be an additional $10.6 million in annual revenue to the state if all of these exemptions were eliminated. We do not expect that would be the outcome of an evaluation, and it would, of course, be offset by an additional $10.6 million to be paid to the state by the currently exempt organizations. We do, however, think that there would be substantial benefit to looking at each of these exemptions and deciding whether the policy purposes are being met and whether these are, in fact, still desirable exemptions to the weight mile tax. So, again, and our recommendation there is to examine them, not necessarily to eliminate all of them.
Tony, that same concept's crossed my mind as I've seen the big trucks out on the highway rolling up and down the freeway that say Department of Corrections. Mm-hmm. I've wondered about that. If they were having to pay their fair share, would they be actually maybe getting a private contractor to do that? And it may be necessary for them to look at it, for them to run that, but it also might be good for us to look at those operations.
Yes, I think that was one of the issues. The other, another one that was raised was the possibility that a local government might extend its tax exempt authority. And the example that was given were the garbage trucks that haul garbage for Metro. Right now, I think someone mentioned that. I think they get exemption from certain taxes, and that by that there is certainly a possibility that they could extend their tax exempt status to the private contractor who currently carries garbage under certain circumstances, and that in particular those types of situations which should be examined. Although, as I said, the recommendation is to examine all of the exemptions, but those were the ones that were generating the most concern.
Just might add that, Senator George, there's considerable discussion also about the original intent of flat fees, which was originally intended to really help the small...
We're talking about exemptions, not flat fees.
Okay, basically. That's right.
We're getting one ahead.
As always, Lloyd's ahead of the rest of us.
Sickening.
Any questions, all right?
Any other questions or comments on exemptions? Okay, our sixth recommendation is to eliminate the use of flat fees. As noted in the report, the vast majority of carriers operating trucks weighing in excess of 26,000 pounds currently pay the weight mile tax. However, motor carriers that haul logs, sand and gravel, or wood chips have the option of paying monthly flat fees in lieu of the weight mile tax. The original intent of the flat fee option apparently was to reduce record keeping requirements for small companies operating few vehicles over public and private roadways. The evidence that was presented indicates that the flat fee no longer seems to meet this objective. First, it is used by a number of large carriers. And second, there's little evidence that it actually reduces record-keeping requirements because most of the record-keeping is required for other purposes as well. Because the fees are intended to raise the same amount of revenue as weight mile tax, elimination should not have any revenue impact. It would, however, improve equity within the weight classes because right now the flat fee is supposed to be set so as to collect the average of all carriers using that particular flat fee within that category, which means that some carriers who travel more than the average number of miles are in effect receiving a tax reduction, and other carriers that travel less than the average number of miles are paying more than they would under the weight mile tax. So it should improve equity. And then finally, there should be an administrative cost savings. Right now, in order to implement the flat fee, there must be a study every 2 years of the flat fee requirements and a recommendation to the legislature on how to set the flat fees based upon cost responsibility. The estimates are that it would save $6,700 every year not to have to do that study. Further comments?
We made that comment.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and the final recommendation from the work group is to repeal the education program requirement. Basically, right now, carriers that receive the permit after 1990 are required to attend an approved new carrier education program. The issues that arise are that the program fee of $60 does not currently cover the cost of the program. ODOT staff may not participate due to constitutional limitation on the use of state highway funds, and the Department of Justice has indicated that ODOT may no longer suspend operating authority for those carriers who fail to attend the seminar. The effect has been that this requirement is largely being ignored and there is no effective enforcement mechanism. So therefore, for simplification purposes, the work group recommends repealing the requirement since it is not being enforced and is not enforceable under current law. And our final comment is that while several of the objectives are clearly in conflict, the recommended changes appear to create a net benefit to both the state and the motor carrier industry. That's our report. Thank you.
All right. Any questions?
We're here to answer questions.
I do have one question. On the recommendation to eliminate or restrict exemptions, do you have those broken down in terms of under current law, an estimate of how many dollars of exemptions for some of the categories you mentioned?
Those do come out in the cost allocation study. I don't remember the numbers offhand.
Okay, that's why I said they were available. I didn't ask them for them, so we could take a look at those and see. Okay.
Yeah. Senator Metzger, we also have a copy of the highway cost allocation study that I could share with you. I'm not sure that they even have a table in that study about the exemptions. They may have just a total number. So we may have to request a breakdown of the exemptions from ODOT and the consultants that were hired for that study.
For the record, John Maris, Policy Section Manager with ODOT. Senator George, Senator Metzger, we can get that information for you,
okay.
Certainly. If it's not actually in the printed highway cost allocation report, we can get it from the consultants that did the study.
Yeah, I mean, if you have it readily, I don't want, you know, five guys spending a week to do this, because if you're not, then don't do it.
Right.
But if the breakdown is there somewhere on a piece of paper, I'd be curious just to see how that, against different groups, you know, just how much of that breakdown goes around. So. Thanks.
Any further questions? Well, listen, let me take this opportunity, and I'm sure the rest of this committee will say the same thing. We want to thank you for your work and for the report, and it was a pleasure to look in and watch the work group in action, and I want to commend each one of you for the absolute professionalism that we saw there, and for the report, and we will be taking action on this issue real soon.
And thank you, Senator.
And thank you also for four of you showing up today. Appreciate that. Okay, I'm going to close the informational meeting that we have been conducting, and at this point I'm going to open a public hearing on HJM 28. Patrick, tell us where we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A House Joint Memorial 28 urges Congress to support and work to pass the tax relief plan introduced by President Bush. It requires a copy of the memorial be sent to each member of the Oregon Congressional Delegation. President Bush's tax plan includes the following proposals: replace current tax rates with a rate structure of 10, 15, 25, and 33%. That's a significant reduction. Increase the child tax credit to $1,000 per child. Apply the credit to the alternative minimum tax. Reinstate the 10% deduction for two-income couples. Eliminate the inheritance tax. Expand the charitable deduction to non-itemizers and make the research and experimentation tax credit permanent. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact for HJM 28.
Welcome, Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, Bruce Starr, State Representative, House District 3 in Washington County. I'm here to speak in favor of House Joint Memorial 28, which encourages Congress to pass the tax relief package proposed by President Bush. In the interest of the committee's time, I will briefly outline what I think are two very basic and fundamental reasons why I believe we can all vote for this piece of legislation, reasons that extend across party lines. Tax cuts are about the re-realization of the American dream, and that is something that both Democrats and Republicans are undoubtedly about. In fact, I was interested to discover that the tax cuts proposed by Kennedy and Reagan, roughly twice and three times as big as the tax cut proposed by President Bush, were passed by Democrat-controlled Congresses. I don't think that has to be any different today. The first reason, of course, to support this memorial is the economy. With the economy in its current unstable and delicate state, a cut in taxes would be a welcome stimulus for economic growth through increased spending and investment on the private side in the private sector. The same principle was brought about the economic boom of the 80s under the Reagan's famed tax cut. Those same principles would apply today. The tax cut would be a significant support under the pressure of layoffs, increased energy prices, and record levels of consumer debt. It does seem to be a day goes by when we don't hear of additional layoffs in the private sector. And I just note that when this bill was on the House floor, I don't have it in my file right here, I looked for it. I had a quote, a recent quote from Fed Chair Greenspan, where he believed that a tax cut today would be a stimulus to the economy and would be favorable to do it sooner rather than later. I have a paraphrase of his quote, but the sooner rather than later was definitely in his quote. Secondly, I believe cutting taxes is the just thing to do. It's the right thing to do. Congress has passed five major tax increases since 1981, including the largest tax increase in the history in 1993. I wish the Blazers had as good a record of winning as Congress does at passing taxes, especially after a game last night. Goodness gracious. In addition, the budget surplus is expected to exceed $5 trillion in the next 10 years. The proposed tax cut would take $1.6 trillion of that surplus and return it to those who have worked their tails off and providing bread and butter not only for the state government, for the federal government as well. Bruce's tax cut uses that money to begin restoring justice to the tax system in a number of ways. First, the Bush tax cut focuses on lower-income families by lowering the bottom income tax rate from 15% to 10%. It doubles the per-child tax credit from $500 to $1,000. Secondly, it eliminates the death tax, which fundamentally attacks the American dream by taxing savings, family-owned businesses, and investment in capital. Thirdly, the Bush tax cut provides tax relief to married couples. It simply isn't right that 21 million American couples pay higher taxes simply because they walk down the aisle and they're married. This tax cut is the right thing to do. Taxation without representation was the rallying cry that birthed our nation, engendered from an overwhelming desire to pursue the American dream uninhibited. Underlying that fundamental idea of representation is the realization proper representatives will do away with unnecessary taxes. When Oregonians are free from the burden such unnecessary taxes bring, it is then that they are truly released to pursue the incredible, precious American dream. With that, Mr. Chair, I would welcome any questions that you might have. I'd urge an aye vote and a rapid movement of this bill to the Senate floor.
Okay, any questions? Thank you, Representative Starr.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next testifier is Mr. Steve Lanning of Oregon AFL-CIO.
Welcome, Steve. We have your letter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and we oppose this on the House side, and we're opposing it on the Senate side as well. Basically, we think that the President's tax cut proposal rewards the richest 1% of taxpayers with somewhere between 22 and 45% of its tax breaks, while leaving the poorest 60% of taxpayers with less than 13% of its benefits. And I've enclosed a table on page 2 from the New York Times that shows a breakdown in the tax of the tax plan. We also are worried that it's a dangerous scheme to commit the money with our fiscal future at stake without actually knowing what kind of surplus we're going to have and in a sense making a good guess on what it might be. And we found a quote from Alan Greenspan a couple of weeks ago cautioning against overcommitting to tax cuts on the basis of a surplus that may evaporate in an economic downturn. I got it off the National AFL-CIO website site. It was a couple of weeks ago. We think that if tax fairness and economic stimulus are the goals of this package, then both goals can be better addressed by adopting the Democratic alternative tax cut that would give immediate tax refunds of $300 per individual or $600 per couple. We think that an alternative plan like that would not rely on future surplus that may not materialize, and it would help working families by putting more money into their pockets that's needed for basic necessities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Steve? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, the next testifier is Mr. Dan Estes from the Oregon Republican Party.
Welcome, Dan.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman George, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Estes. I'm the political director for the Oregon Republican Party. Today I'm going to be offering testimony on behalf of Solomon Yu, who is our national committee man. Unfortunately, Mr. Yu was unavailable to give this today as he is in Washington, D.C., visiting with the president as we speak. I, however, am not, so I'm going to read his letter for you. Chairman George and members of the committee, I come before you today to urge your support and passage of House Joint Memorial 28. This memorial requests our congressional delegation to support President Bush's $1.6 trillion tax cut proposal. This memorial passed the House on Monday, March 26th, with broad bipartisan support, showing that this is an issue for all Oregonians. There are many reasons to support this tax cut plan, but the greatest one in my mind is the principle. In a free society, the government must return to the people what is rightfully theirs. It is indeed a privilege for me today to present my opinion to you. You see, I was born and raised in communist China. Before I came to this great country, I worked in a Chinese pharmacy 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, and was paid the equivalent of $30 a month. You can say that the communist government took 99.9% of the fruits of my labor. I was, in fact, an economic slave of the government because I did not control my own economic destiny. If I expressed my desire to keep more money in a society which tried to achieve economic equality among its citizens, I could disappear in the night. To me, A desire to keep more of our hard-earned money is not only an issue about who really owns the fruits of our labor, but also an issue of being a free man in a free society. How free are we if the government takes away more than 50% of our earnings? Some in Congress are using class warfare rhetoric to oppose President Bush's tax cut proposal. I have heard these slogans before in communist China. If they succeed, this land of the free would be moved further closer to the kind of society from which I escaped. I believe nobody in this room who believes in freedom thinks that it is acceptable for the government to take the majority of our earnings. To me, demanding a refund from our overcharged tax bill is also an ethical issue. I believe that nobody in this room would disagree with me that when your neighborhood supermarket overcharges you, you should demand a refund. If you would not let your neighborhood supermarket get by without a refund, why should you let your government? Finally, this tax cut could not have come at a better time for our hardworking citizens, and by extension, our economy. The Dow Jones is below 10,000 and the NASDAQ is less than 2,000. We are facing an economic slowdown. As a result, our hardworking taxpayers are forced to cut back on spending for their personal needs. As a government for the people, it is the responsible course of action to act in the best interests of our people by reducing our tax burden. Chairman George and members of the committee, I strongly urge you to join our president to free our hardworking taxpayers from the current tax burden and remove the shackles from our sluggish economy by passing this memorial. This tax cut proposal is no longer a Republican issue or a Democrat issue. It is an issue of doing the right thing for our people. Our people and our economy need not only this tax cut proposed by our president, but the renewed confidence in our government as an entity that honors this principle of giving back when too much has been taken from us. If you have any questions, please feel free to call me. I thank you for this opportunity, and God bless our free country. Respectfully submitted, Solomon U. Jr.
Thank you for reading Solomon's letter. Dan, are you prepared to take any questions if anyone has any?
Unless someone would like to imagine me as a short Chinese man with boundless energy, go right ahead. I'm happy to speak on behalf of the Republican Party if anybody has any questions.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, the next testifiers are Russ Walker and Rex Daines from the Citizens for a Sound Economy.
Welcome. I'll let you two decide who's going to go first. State your name for the record and then proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Russ Walker with Citizens for Sound Economy. I'm the Oregon director of Citizens for Sound Economy. We're an organization with over 250,000 members nationwide. In the state of Oregon, we have nearly 10,000 members. On the behalf of the 8,000 members of Oregon Citizens for Sound Economy, that number is actually incorrect. It's actually closer to 10,000. I would like to urge you to vote for HJM 28, the resolution to support President Bush's tax cut proposal. For the past 3 months, thousands of CSE members have attended town hall meetings and forums around the country and throughout the state of Oregon. I have personally conducted dozens of those town hall meetings here in the state of Oregon. And just over the last 2 weeks, I was in Bend, Oregon, as well as Coos Bay, where we had upwards of 50 people in Coos Bay and a good number in Bend that attended to hear the details of the tax cut proposal and also show their support for tax cuts. We've also been to a number of other communities as diverse as Portland, Oregon, to Ontario and Astoria. Nearly every single one of these grassroots citizens agrees that President Bush's proposal is the right plan for America and will fight to see it passed in Congress. There's a great deal of enthusiasm out there right now for tax cuts. And I think that President Bush's plan, as we go through it very quickly, is the right plan for what we need at this time. Given the slowing economy, and let me add right now, I think upwards of 200,000 layoffs have occurred in the last 2 months nationwide. And just today, there was an announcement of another 11,000 layoffs. And I can't remember the name of the company, very, very large producer of auto parts accessories laid off 11,000 workers here in this nation just today. So the country is beginning to go through what I believe is not just a slowdown, but entering a recession, and we really won't see the worst of it until I think after we realize the effects our energy problems are going to have, which we won't until this summer, later this summer. And with record budget surpluses amassing in Washington, D.C., and the time has never been right. Has never been quite as right for tax cuts as it is today. CSE enthusiastically supports the full $1.6 trillion package developed by the Bush administration. This proposal calls for about half of the $3 trillion in surpluses, which, let me just add, is does not include the Social Security surpluses. Doesn't touch the Social Security surpluses. This is a conservative plan that accounts for possible fluctuations in the size of the surplus. That's very important, especially as we look at the coming economy and what's going to happen. They've reserved at least half of that surplus for paying down the debt and for other possible problems with the coming economy. Cutting marginal rates is the first element of the tax cut. There's three elements: the cutting marginal rates, then the death tax, elimination of death tax or estate tax, and then thirdly, the reduction in the marriage penalty tax. Cutting marginal rates means that every American who pays taxes would get tax relief. All working Americans deserve tax relief, and as Democrat Senator Zell Miller has recently said, Washington, D.C. should not play eeny, meeny, miny, moe with tax cuts. And I think that's an important message. I think what we saw, too, last week or earlier this week on the House side of this legislative body was a bipartisan support for the tax cut. We had 12 Democrats and 43 Republicans support a tax cut, and I think primarily because they know that the members, their constituents, need a tax cut at this time, and an across-the-board tax cut that affects every income level, every income payer or taxpayer in this state as well as in the nation. Currently, there's five tax rates, and the Bush plan would limit that down to four. Additionally, it would not only limit the tax rate, but the lowest working poor, or sometimes referred as, would see a reduction in their numbers from one in every five current working poor would be removed from the current tax rolls. Now, that equates out to about 7 million households nationwide. I don't know about you, but that's real tax relief, if you ask me. If you're currently paying taxes and you're barely making it, and someone comes to you and says you don't have to pay taxes tomorrow, that's real tax relief. That can do a lot for families struggling to pay their bills, struggling to pay for the daycare because both parents are working. That's real tax relief. Secondly, in the second portion of the Republican tax plan, or the Bush tax plan, is the death tax elimination. We look at the death tax as an unfair tax and an un-American tax. It taxes American values. And just let me quickly say, it's an environmentally unfriendly tax. And what I mean by that, and that is not in my speech, but let me quickly just develop that thought for a moment so you get a good picture. In Washington County today, we have a lot of family farms or farms. Frequently what happens is if they do not plan for their estates early enough, what happens is the family ends up selling off the farm when the owner of the patriarch of the family or matriarch of the family passes away. This recently happened down in Douglas County to one of our members. They had to sell half their tree farm to pay the taxes, the death taxes, for their father. Now what that means typically in a place like Washington County is that usually means that they sell the whole farm rather than just half the farm. Rather than having to deal with having to keep the farm, try to struggle to keep it alive, they sell the whole farm, and it ends up usually being developed into housing developments or some other form of commercial development. Additionally, the overwhelming majority of Americans agree that this is a fundamentally wrong tax. It taxes earnings that have already been taxed, and it taxes them again at death. Furthermore, the death tax punishes American values and savings and investing by preventing individuals from passing the property along to their families. And this is another statistic that you might find interesting. 70% of family-owned businesses today never make it to the second generation. There's a lot of reasons for that, but we believe one of those reasons, one of the primary reasons for that, is the death tax. It is definitely a tax on the American values and what we value most, which is investing in the community, creating jobs, working and putting your own resources online and building a successful business. Finally, the marriage penalty is yet another example of the federal government punishing American values and traditions. The penalty occurs when dual-income couples are taxed at a higher rate when they file jointly than when they file individually. President Bush's plan would allow second earners to deduct up to $3,000 from their overall tax burden, thus greatly reducing the impact of the marriage penalty. Also, by condensing and lowering tax rates, Bush's plan would negate the effects of the penalty for many married couples. And I can tell you that's very important for a lot of people. And I'll just give you one example. We had at the meeting in Coos Bay, we had a senior citizen stand up and ask a question about this and then give her a little story. And one of the things she mentioned was that the marriage penalty is hitting senior citizens where it hurts, and that is because they live on a very fixed income, and typically it's not a large income. And if they marry, if they have a spouse that dies and they remarry, then they have to file jointly. And so that income then is doubled, typically. And say they each earn $10,000. When they marry, their dual income now is $20,000, and their taxes, though they made $20,000, whereas if they continue to live together outside of marriage separately, and for the, what this woman told me and how she described it is violating what she has always held close to her heart, her morals throughout her life, living together so that they can continue to survive in the current environment, and that way they could continue to file separately instead of jointly. This would help alleviate some of those things that many people face, not just people just entering the workforce, the young people in our society, but also senior citizens who live on a very fixed income. So the marriage penalty is an element of the tax cut that was being debated today in Congress. And this is another thing I want to mention. This came up on the House side, and I want to make sure everyone's clear on this. The only thing that's passed out of Congress thus far is the marginal rate reduction portion of the tax cut. The death tax and the marriage penalty reduction has not, to my knowledge. It might have passed out today. The marriage penalty reduction might have passed out today, but I'm not certain about that. Finally, let me just say in conclusion before Rex makes a couple comments. The president's proposal is the right proposal for America and Oregon. Supporting HJM is really a pretty simple thing for Oregon legislators. And what we want to do is send a message to our congressional delegation that Oregonians by and large support this tax cut, and not only support it but need it. It has been 20 years since Oregonians have had a major, Americans have had a major tax reduction. That is a whole generation of Americans that are living today that have never seen a major tax cut. That's my generation. I've never seen one the whole time I've been working, but I have seen five major increases in taxes, including the famous Read My Lips tax, as well as the Clinton tax.
Russ, I don't want to rush you, but I'm going to lose committee members in just a little
Thank
bit.
Thank you, Senator. Okay. I'm finished, but I urge you to please vote yes on this. Right. It is important to Americans and Oregonians.
Thank you very much, Rex.
My name's Rex Daines. Thank you, Chair George and Senators. I'm a partner in the law firm of Olson, Olson, Morgan, and Daines, and I'm here speaking on that capacity today. I practice bankruptcy law. It's a very unglamorous area of the law, but somebody has to do it, I guess. I've been asked by Russ to talk a little bit about my clients and the effect of the taxes they're paying now and what a potential decrease would be for them. I'd like to break it into two categories. First is the wage earner. Most of my clients have between $20,000 and $30,000 of credit card debt when they come to see me. This is debt that's built up over several years, and they get to a point where they realize that they're getting further behind each month instead of further ahead. The decision to file a bankruptcy by people isn't based on the amount of debt they have. It's based on the amount of money they have after paying their normal living expenses, their rent and food, and whether or not the amount left at the end of the money at the end of the month covers the interest on the debt that they're carrying. And so I think with the lower income taxes, the president held up a big check, you know, $1,600 per family, and that doesn't sound like very much, but an extra $100 or $150 for a family who's just getting by, a little bit extra to apply to their debt, to the principal amount of their debt, would keep a lot of people out of the bankruptcy system. Second is for self-employed individuals. An unproportionately high number of my clients are self-employed individuals, and almost all of them come to me with a tax debt that they haven't been able to pay. When we do a Chapter 13 reorganization, we need a little leniency from the court. In a payment plan, we tell the judge that it's a tax plan, and the judge knows what that means, and everyone in the debtor-creditor bar knows what that means. That means they're here because they owe a lot of taxes, even though they've kept their other situation pretty much debt-free, and generally a little more leniency is given to those to help them repay those taxes. But it is stifling to a lot of small businesses the amount of taxes that they need to pay, trying to live the American dream. I'm sure you've all heard that recently sweeping bankruptcy reform has been passed in the National Congress. This was done as a result of increasing bankruptcy numbers over the past 15 years. Ironically, the bankruptcy laws have barely changed during that time. In fact, it's a little harder to file a bankruptcy now than it was 15 years ago. The laws that have changed that affected a lot of people who filed bankruptcy are the tax laws, which have increased over that time. I urge you to vote yes on HJM 28. I think it will benefit the average hardworking American. I'd just like to close by saying what my partner says. I walked out the door. He said, I should urge you to vote no, because increased taxes or a high tax rate will just increase our business and we'll make more money. So it's a little bit of irony. I'm here selflessly telling you that a lower taxes will benefit hardworking Americans. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
No one else is signed up to testify, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session with the tap of the gavel on House Joint Memorial 28. Senator Clarno.
Okay.
Senator Clarno has moved House Joint Memorial 28 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Senator Mesker.
So that everyone understands, I'm sorry he's gone, but I can understand my good friend, Representative Starr, and I, so that he does not misinterpret, because I very much appreciate his sincerity in this. I'm voting against this memorial, as I have voted against other memorials, regardless of my friends or people who may not be of the same persuasion. I just find it ridiculous to spend these thousands of dollars for these memorials when we can send a letter to Earl and Greg, you know, for 34 cents, and I got one right here, you know, urging a tax cut. We could sign it and send it to them, then spending those thousands of dollars to send it to our friends. And I vote against those for that reason, and all, regardless of the issue of this particular one, for the same. And anybody wants to sign the letter asking for the tax cut, I'll do it. Senator Cuta made a good point last session when we were urging for waivers so that we could help some of our people in our homes, and we sent a letter around, and we all signed it and sent it, and I thought it was much more effective, and it was certainly a lot cheaper. So there's my 2 cents worth, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mesker. And he warned me about this, and I told him, gee, that'll probably make a little dent in my idea to send a joint memorial asking that we maximize return of federal dollars. So we probably will go with a letter from the committee, I think. Any further comments? Okay. Thank you very much. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
No.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator
Mesker?
Aye.
Senator
Mesker?
No.
Senator Hill?
Aye. Senate Joint Memorial has passed and sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Well, not with a due pass recommendation. And do we have a period? Not yet. Okay. We will postpone that. What I'm going to do now is close the work session on House Joint Memorial 28. And with the staff of the gavel, we're going to open a public hearing. We're going to lose committee members in just a second on Senate Bill 868. And what we'll probably do is, let's just do that first.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 868 requires the Oregon Department of Transportation to develop and apply a credit risk assessment model for motor carriers for the purposes of bonding requirements and enables ODOT to not require bonds from carriers with low risk of tax default. Requires bonds in specified amounts for high and medium risk carriers. It deletes requirements that ODOT issue Oregon tax plates to motor carriers. Oregon, in a little background, Oregon enacted the nation's first 8-mile tax in 1947. 8-mile tax is a graduated fee based on the weight of a vehicle and the miles it travels. In Oregon, Oregon is only one of four states in the nation, the others being Kentucky, New Mexico, and New York, that impose a weight mile tax on motor carriers. As you all know, the Senate General Government Transportation Committee formed the Weight Mile Tax Streamlining Group to investigate methods for tax streamlining and efficiency through paperwork reduction, reduction of administrative requirements, and electronic efficiency. The work group analyzed a broad spectrum of streamlining concepts, and following careful consideration of each concept, the work group produced several recommendations, which you heard today. Senate Bill 868 is simply a placeholder and was designed as a vehicle for implementing the recommendations of that work group. And we have three representatives of the trucking industry who have signed up to testify, Mr. Al Elkins, Mr. Bob Russell, and Mr. D. Bridges.
Okay, what I would do, we're going to lose this committee. Since you guys realize we have a placeholder bill, we're going to bring in the recommendation we had heard here, plus we believe parallel language from the House bill. So if you guys don't mind, we'll just go ahead and close it till we get it done, then we'll bring it back.
Sounds good.
Sounds good?
And Mr. Chair, I can tell you I had a meeting with a representative of the trucking industry and a representative of the Oregon Department of Transportation. There are two House bills that carry all the elements, as far as I can tell, that were recommended by the work groups. So if those two House bills were used to either gut the stuff of the Senate bill or were simply passed, I think that the recommendations would be implemented.
Okay, great. Well, that's good news. We'll look forward to putting that together. And with that, if there's no further business come before the committee, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 868. With a tap of the gavel, we'll be adjourned. Thank you. Get my joint.